Greetings and welcome to Trottle Up. This is a radio show and podcast that showcases critical thinking and complex problem solving. And it is designed to inform, delimit, empower, and amaze. Now, all aboard the Trottle Up Express, powered by High Velocity Reason, and I am your host, Captain Kevin Smith, U.S. Navy retired. Now, I'm a naval aviator and former squadron commander and Top Gun instructor as a naval aviator. And also, I'm a pioneer in the field of some aspects of critical thinking and complex problem solving, and of course, high velocity reason. Now, our tagline for the show is to accelerate beyond the ordinary. So we could say that we are not ordinary thinkers, you and I, but we are different and we are out of the box thinkers. Our motto for the show is to employ high velocity reason to achieve high octane performance. And in a nutshell, that basically means to stay out ahead of the problem. That's particularly important if we want to achieve success. Now, our mission statement for the show, and this changes a little bit from time to time, but this is a pretty good mission statement, is to provide our listening audience with a relatively easy yet effective way to strengthen our power of reason through the employment of critical thinking. Now, our website, the address here is throttleupradio.com. That's throttleupradio.com. That's the address for the website. And before we close on our introduction, I wanted to say that our audio engineering services is provided by Evergroove Studios, and they are located in Evergreen, Colorado, which is right outside of Denver on the west side. Highly recommend their services for anyone who wants to get involved with audio. It could be any kind of audio that you might have in mind, including music, by the way. Also, graphics artist services and media support is provided by Reflections Printing, and the gal is Jennifer. She heads up this organization, and she owns it as well. And Jennifer does a great job with all of our media support, is a fantastic graphics artist and media production specialist, and her phone number is 435-574-0422. That's 435-574-0422. And before we close the introduction, I want to say that the show is typically organized into three parts. So part one of Throttle Up is critical thinking, or an ongoing discussion of various aspects of critical thinking and complex problem solving. Part two is our storyboard, and the storyboard is a story of America, or a story of Americans, story of an individual. It could be any kind of story, but it all relates to trying to get our arms around this whole thing, which we call critical thinking and complex problem solving. And then part three is our radio essay. Now, our radio essay is typically a little bit more in-depth treatment of a particular subject. We do not intend for this to be boring. But for those who would like a little bit more info on certain things that we cover in part one and part two, then part three typically is a way for us to get a little bit further into a subject matter and understand it better. Okay, all aboard the Throttle Up Express. This is a place where all critical thinkers and complex problem solvers are welcome with open arms. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up for this week. And we have a full show today. And we often have a little bit more than we can fit into an hour, but that's okay. Now, the show this week, we're going to be talking about what's currently in the headlines. In particular, we're going to be talking about the Boeing 737 MAX series of airplanes. That's the 737-800 MAX and the 737-900 MAX. And, of course, this situation is all over the news, and rightly so. And it is a catastrophe. It is whatever has caused this catastrophic situation to develop. It has cost a lot of lives. And, you know, from my perspective, as one who has spent most of his adult life in the field of aviation, from my perspective, it was certainly a preventable occurrence. This accident clearly should never have happened. There was lots of checks along the way that should have occurred. And we're going to cover some of them today on this part one of this show, which we call Critical Thinking. And, you know, you can say, okay, well, Kevin, it's a little bit more complicated than just applying some critical thinking principles to a particular situation. Don't we need to know a lot about the data, flight data recorder? Don't we need to know a lot about all kinds of esoteric things and also all kinds of minutiae? And my response would be, number one, you know, I have dealt with similar issues in my aviation career. I've been involved in a lot of problem-solving initiatives throughout my career in aviation that goes back well over 50 years. And no, that, you know, a lot of that stuff is a cop-out. A lot of that stuff is assuming that somehow there is some deep insight into the data, and there isn't. Data is just data. It is not knowledge. It's not insight. It's rather silly to go there when we should be looking at how come all of the checks that this thing should have gone through, how come all these checks failed? We just don't design and then throw the airplane out into the marketplace without it having to accomplish and go through a number of checks, a number of efforts to certify its airworthiness. And that, as it turns out, remarkably and rather distressingly, that was not done, or it was not done in a way that it should have been done. And the first order of business is this an engineering problem, or is this a cognitive problem relating to the lack of critical thinking? My position is that this is a problem of the latter. This is not an engineering problem. This is a problem of critical thinking, or lack thereof. And so we're going to cover that, and I'm going to try to, you know, add some weight to this proposition that I have made, try to add some credibility to it, try to prove the point that this was actually a problem of critical thinking rather than other things. There is certainly the aspects of the man-machine interface. Sometimes that's called human-machine interface, I guess, to update it to be more politically correct. It started out when I was working in the field of aviation and design early on. We would call it man-machine interface. And so, you know, that's okay with me. I know it's not okay with everybody, but that's just the way it is. So what about this thing that we call man-machine interface? Well, it's a particularly challenging area. It is one that has gotten a lot of people concerned over the years. Not really much has been done about it. It seems to be some kind of a set of inhibiting factors. There seems to be some kind of a blockage. There seems to be some kind of a wall. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of innovation that is going on in this area. And frankly, I'm not exactly sure why that is. But the man-machine interface issue doesn't have a lot of people working in it that you would consider to be out-of-the-box thinkers, that you would consider to be looking at some innovative solutions to this thing. And my position is this. We have often, bought into the fact that the human needs to adapt to the machine because the machine has been built. It is non-adaptive in nature. Often many of our machines are hardware. They are tangible products. Up until recently, that's not true anymore, but until recently, the machine has been a fixed entity, whereas the human is not. Human is adaptable. Human is agile, or can be. A human can do many, many things, and the human can solve problems. The machine cannot solve problems in any kind of meaningful way. I suppose theoretically you could say that the machine could help solve problems, but it doesn't actually solve problems. It's the human that solves problems, and the human really has that level of intelligence, that level of consciousness. I call it higher order reasoning. Now, higher order reasoning is a particularly important thing to bring into the discussion, because while critical thinking is, in fact, the bedrock discipline, more and more people are recognizing this. As you know, the Future of Jobs report put out by the World Economic Forum talks about this at great length. They propose that critical thinking and complex problem solving now is the number one sought-after skill in the global job market, and it's also the most difficult to fill. So if critical thinking and complex problem solving is, in fact, the number one sought-after skill in the global job market, then what are we doing about it? And I would say that right now we're not doing a lot about it. We are just kind of like muddling through and going on with the way we used to do things and the way, how did we build systems like the Boeing 737 Max? How are we building systems? Well, we're building systems like the 737 Max utilizing the old industrial model. And what is that? The old industrial model is based upon the tangible and the literal. All right, so the machine then is, in fact, the piece of hardware that we use, the tool, if you will, that we use to travel through time and space quickly, and that is the frozen in time and space. That is what it is. And it's the human that makes the adjustments to enable the machine to function. The machine doesn't make the adjustments to support the human, and it doesn't do anything to support higher order reasoning. Higher order reasoning, of course, is essential in many of the things that we do, including, and probably the top of the list would be military operations. In military operations, nothing is a given. There's lots and lots of opportunities and the need for higher order reasoning. And while we might use sophisticated equipment along the way, the equipment doesn't do the reasoning, and the equipment doesn't solve the battle problem, and the equipment doesn't win the war. It's the human that does that, as well as business, too. More and more, we realize that in a complex business environment, complex business situation, it's the human that is the deciding factor, the insight, the intelligence, the intuition, the innovation of the human, or we can say the ability for the human to think critically and to solve problems quickly and effectively and get on with the job of achieving some kind of mission success. And so that becomes the driving force. Now, what is going on with the Boeing 737 MAX situation and catastrophe? Okay, so right now, as we record this radio show, and this is a podcast also, so you can go to iTunes and get this show in podcast format. I would encourage all of you to do so, because what I'm going to say about the 737 MAX is particularly important, and it has enduring qualities to it. What is going on? The first thing to discuss is design. How is it that this airplane was designed the way it was? Number two, did it go through the critical design review? Number three, was it flight tested? Number four, did it comply with all of the regulatory issues, or did it achieve regulatory compliance? And was it certified by the regulatory agency to be airworthy and to be safe with respect to a public transportation system? And then finally, what kind of operator training was proposed? Why was the operator training proposed? Was the training that was offered, what did it go through the training development cycle? Were training objectives specified? Did it go through some kind of an analytic process by which we achieve those particular performance objectives or training objectives, if you will? If you like the training objective thing, that's okay. In my work, we used proficiency objectives. What are they, and how do we achieve those objectives in a timely and effective way? Okay, the first thing is design. What is going on with the airplane, and why do we need MCAS? MCAS is Maneuver Characteristics Augmentation System. It's kind of a strange term. That's an acronym in, aviation. Aviation loves acronyms. Often it's a bit silly. In this case, I think it's a bit silly. Anyway, so what's going on with the airplane? All right, so the 737 MAX series is the 800, 900 MAX. All right, so that's a bit of a different kind of airplane. What they tried to do is they tried to fit this airplane into the 737 shoebox. It doesn't actually fit in the 737 shoebox, but they kind of forced it in there because they wanted to make sure, or they wanted to ensure that the airlines could purchase an airplane that could transition very quickly into their fleet or into their operations that was similar enough to older model 737s that there was little or no additional training that was required. They could use the same training footprint and the same training simulators. And as it turns out, it's kind of a suite of simulators. There's not just one flight simulator for this particular airplane. In most cases, you have at least two. You have a fixed base simulator and a full mission simulator, and you might have three or four. That could be a desktop simulator also. So they wanted it to fit within that structure so that there was little or no additional things that were needed to be done. And so they force fit it into that structure. And so what is going on with the airplane? Well, the airplane is a particularly different kind of airplane. It has different aerodynamic properties to it and also has different systems and what have you. And so in Boeing's effort to make this as similar to the other Boeing 737s as much as possible to eliminate any additional costs that the air carrier might have in introducing this airplane into their operation, they were fiddling around with some of the aerodynamic features and some of the control responses to these aerodynamic features. So basically, it's the airplane has different aerodynamic properties because it is characteristically different than other Boeing 737s. All right. What exactly does that mean? It means that it handles differently, different enough that you probably ought to call it a different airplane, or it ought to be called a different model and require additional hands-on training, not textbook training, but hands-on training to be able to deal with the different aerodynamic characteristics of this particular airplane. And in particular, this airplane has a tendency to exceed a normal pitch attitude. So the pitch axis, if you will, it's also called the longitudinal axis for those people that like aerodynamics. The pitch axis, this airplane was very pitch sensitive in certain regimes. And so Boeing decided that, okay, so it was characteristically different. We had to do something system-wise to keep it within the 737 shoebox. Okay, so they tried to do this, and so they came up with this, among other things, by the way. I'm sure this is not the only thing, but among other things, they came up with this MCAS system, which was designed to ease the transition between this airplane and the older models of the 737, so it became largely the same. All right, so this was a kind of an artificial system that was put between the pilot control feature and the control, the aerodynamic controls on the airplane. So something was inserted between those two things, and there should have been nothing there. It should have been a pure control loop, and it wasn't. There was an automatic system that intervened in that control loop. It intervened in a way that was unknown to the pilot. It was obscured from pilot understanding and pilot attention. There was nothing in the cockpit that would alert the crew that this particular system was in fact intervening in the control loop. So it was not a pure control loop. It was a control loop that was contaminated with a system that was poorly designed. And so this contaminated loop was doomed to failure, as it turns out. And so that ought to have been the first red flag that went up, is that you have a system that is intervening automatically into a control loop that should be clearly understandable to the operator. And it wasn't clearly understandable to the operator. There was a belief that this system did not have to be clearly understandable to the operator. And during its activation or lack of activation, the flight crew did not know what was happening or what should be happening. Now, you could go both ways, and that's particularly important. So you could say that, okay, was the system activating automatically when it should have been activating. Or the other way of saying that is looking at it from the negative perspective. Was the system not activating when it should have been activating? So both warning features should have been made available to the flight crew, and it wasn't. And that is particularly important here from what we call a man-machine interface. It was a breakdown of the basic ideas of the man-machine interface in terms of operating these complex dynamic systems. Okay, the second big thing here is critical design review. So if you have a system that activates automatically and intervenes in a way that contaminates the control loop or intervenes in a way that the operator is unaware of, and there is some intervention into the control loop that the operator is not aware of, how do you get that through the critical design review? In other words, did that review look at all the operational realities that could occur in a air transport environment? And here I think is one of the key breakdowns in critical thinking. So critical thinking, in my view, critical thinking needs to, among other things, look at the actual, clarify the actual is a key phrase that I often use. Look at the actual environment. What actually is the environment in which this machine operates? Not some kind of a made-up environment, or not just a small segment of the full environment, but does this machine operate, and can it operate within the full operational spectrum? And if it does it perform well under all of these environmental conditions? That's the key. And the critical design review should be looking at that in a very thorough and very analytical way. And I would say that did not happen, because if it did happen, then this intervention into the control loop should have been highlighted as a serious risk factor. Flight test. Okay, these things should have been properly flight tested under all regimes that the airplane could in fact encounter. And was it flight tested? And what would happen when it failed to function, or what would happen when it did function, but it did in an inappropriate way? And what was the firewall set up so that it could not override a pilot input, but it could just assist the pilots when it sensed that the pilot was commanding a certain control deflection? It assisted that without becoming overwhelming. And so the assist mode should have been more or less gentle in trying to help the pilot through this particular maneuver, and in some cases through this particularly difficult maneuver. So not sure that it did that. I would say that it didn't. Regulatory compliance is the next thing. So what about that? Well, there are, in fact, regulations. We call them Federal Air Regulations, FARs. There are a number of regulations that pertain to this particular airplane in this particular situation. For those government regulations, were they just rubber stamped, or did they go through a thorough review process to make sure that all of the regulations were in fact complied with? And that clearly didn't happen. Certification, of course, once it completes that regulatory compliance review and it completes the flight test phase, this airplane should have been flight tested. You know, and frankly, I think it had to have been flight tested, but I'm not sure how thorough the flight testing was. But once the regulation compliance is done, and once it completes the flight testing, and then you have the certification process. Again, this is not rubber stamped. This goes through a particularly rigorous process before this system and this airplane. This airplane is in fact certified to carry passengers. And finally, last but not least, is pilot training. What kind of training? And I would also add to this maintenance training as well as pilot training. What kind of training was necessary for the operators and the maintainers? And how do we know that the training is in fact appropriate? In other words, was the training that we have being that was being proposed, was it analytically derived? And that's the key. Was the training analytically derived? And was there, since this was a different aerodynamic entity, did the training include training in realistic simulators, the simulators that actually were able to flight simulate this particular model, the 737 MAX? You know, I've talked to one airline that is flying it, and they don't have simulators right now that actually do simulate the 737 MAX airplane. And that simulation upgrade to the MAX should have been accomplished. I'm not even sure, frankly. I guess I need to do more work on this thing. I'm not even sure if any airline has a 737 MAX upgrade to their full flight simulators. That's a very good question. I'm not even sure how this thing could have been certified for airline operation without simulators being available. Okay, so in conclusion, what can we say? Well, you know, there's a lot of hoops that the company and the government, the industry should have. The manufacturers, the airline industry, and the regulatory agencies should have jumped through. There's a lot of things that should have been done in a very professional and thorough way. And clearly something happened. There were some serious failures. And so our challenge is this. And I think this goes across the board for any of these industries that are having difficulty like this. The automobile industry has had its share of difficulties. The oil and gas industry has had its share of difficulties. Now we see the aviation industry is having its share of difficulties. And on and on. I know the financial industry has had its share of difficulties in the recent past. And the medical community has had its share of difficulties, particularly in the area of surgery. There's been enormous strides made because there were some serious difficulties associated with medical surgery on a global basis. And so they've had their difficulties too. And the list goes on and on. And so I guess we could say that are all of these unique occurrences within each industry, or are there common attributes across all of these industries? I would say that there's a lot of common ground here, and we ought to look at this from a, a higher order reasoning perspective. And I would say that we have a tendency as, I guess we could say as humans, we have a tendency to try to fix the glitch instead of solve the problem. Again, as humans, we tend to want to fix the glitch, or at least propose that this thing is fixed instead of trying to really solve the problem. Because if we solve the problem, then other similar kinds of breakdowns, other similar kinds of critical problems will not arise. Okay, so that completes at least this week's discussion. Now, hang on, because there's going to be other, I'm sure, other things that have emerged as we progress forward in this effort to solve this problem once and for all for this particular industry. And there may be lessons for other industries. So stay tuned, and now we will press on to part two. Okay, welcome back to, this is actually going to be part three. So we are going to be doing a radio essay, and we started this last week, and I wanted to spend some quality time on this thing. And we'll probably be doing this for a number of shows. But the radio essay is about this new book that has recently come out, and I just got my copy of it. Fresh off the press, and the new book is entitled The Case for Trump, and it is written by Victor Davis Hanson. And if you don't know who he is, I think most people do, rather important figure in history as well as American politics. He's also a recipient of a number of awards. I don't have all of that. I think he won the National Humanitarian Award some time back. Very prestigious award and highly regarded individual. Anyway, so he just released a new book, The Case for Trump. And I'm going to read some excerpts from this important book and make some comments along the way. Again, full credit to Victor Davis Hanson for this fine piece of work. Also, he has done a rather remarkable job in the area of world history, particularly in the area of history of World War II. In fact, I think he has a fairly new book on that. He has an unusual and compelling way to understand history, have a historical perspective with a particular point of view that's rather unusual. And I think it's, you could say oftentimes it's unique. It's also very refreshing. He brings to the table some refreshingly new ideas about the human condition, about history, ancient and recent history, and also what's going on socio-politically in this country and across the world today. And he often uses his historical perspective, his deep insight into history, to help explain and help all of us understand what is actually going on. And so I want to start by talking about chapter two in his book. Chapter two is called Trumpism. And what he's trying to do here is trying to understand what is this phenomena President Trump, Donald J. Trump, has brought to the surface, has brought to the American culture. What exactly is this phenomena? And so we're going to be talking about this, and he talks about it. He starts out by saying, to leverage the cultural and class divide to win the Republican primaries and to fuel a general election bid, Trump zoomed in on a number of signature issues. I would say here that this is particularly important and insightful, and I would say that President Trump has a great deal of credit here because he was able to focus and zoom in on and target a number of issues that he felt were important. So Mr. Hanson goes on to say that all of them at various times had been the haphazard property of earlier right-wing, and on occasion left-wing populists. But from the moment that Trump announced his candidacy, he monotonously hammered these concerns as if they were uniquely novel in his own throughout the campaign, the presidential transition, and his first 2 years in office. Even more unusual, Mr. Hansen goes on to say, what Trump ran on in 2015 and 16, he almost immediately sought to implement as president in 2017 and 18. That consistency rallied his base, but it also astonished his critics, who privately had consoled themselves after his victory along the lines of, at least Trump cannot be serious. But he was, and he made that clear with a number of agendas. Candidate and then President Trump faulted Bush's Republicans as much as Obama's Democrats for optional, costly, and inconsequential wars from Iraq to Libya. For Trump, the objection was not that intervening abroad was necessarily immoral. Rather, such interventions were allegedly fought for ungrateful others at the expense of Americans at home, especially the working class. In political terms, Trump decided to run against much of the current Washington bipartisan foreign policy establishment and the previous three administrations that had intervened in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. When Trump serially complained, "We don't win wars anymore," he did not mean just the United States should be more muscular in finishing conflicts. Specifically, Mr. Hansen says, America should fight more reactively than preemptively, but only where America can realistically win. Well, he says, Trump is quoting Trump here. Well, I'll tell you what, I don't mind fighting, Trump conceded in February 2016, but you have got to win. And number one, we don't win wars, we just fight. We just fight. It's like a big, like you're vomiting, just fight, fight, fight. For Trump, I don't mind fighting apparently meant that he could bomb the stuffing out of ISIS and then leave, but staying in or even trying to get out of Afghanistan would be more like vomiting. For Trump, the eventual geostrategic stakes were less important than one-time Oakland Raiders owner Al Davis's truism, just win, baby. Apparently, Trump cynically understood war and grand strategy as rather analogous to the nature of the business world. What people profess is really predicated on perceptions of success and resulting esteem. Win a war and why and how it started are less important. Lose a war and subtly blame ensues over who dreamed up such a debacle. Mr. Hansen goes on to say the Greek historian Cyclades, in a more general sense, said the same thing over 2,400 years ago, when he distinguished the pretext from the true cause. Trump, Mr. Hansen says, had an uncanny ability to prune away the pretext and get to the heart of what people thought rather than what they professed. Trump, the TV star and entrepreneur, also placed a high value on ratings and money in such a commercial value system. Wars were deals, or rather frequently bad deals, that could quickly prove too unpopular and costly to be worth the intended results. Yet only fighting winnable wars for strategically logical aims is more easily promised than done. Once in office, Trump himself would renege on some of his campaign promises to leave Afghanistan. He said, for example, that we made a terrible mistake getting involved there in the first place. Trump admitted in October 2015, we had real brilliant thinkers that didn't know what the heck they were doing, and it's a mess. It's a mess. And at this point, you probably have to say, because that thing will collapse about 2 seconds after they leave. During his first month in office, President Trump was still channeling those campaign themes to White House visiting executives. He said, we've spent $6 trillion in the Middle East. We got nothing. We've got nothing. We never even kept a small, even a tiny oil well. No one, not one little oil well. I said, keep the oil. As President Trump would soon learn, that the United States has 700 million facilities around the world and treaty responsibilities with allies whose autonomy depended on American bombers, soldiers, and warships. The dilemma then would be how to deter Syria from using chemical weapons against children, to send a message to Syria's Russian abettors to cease their sponsorship of Syrian President al-Assad, and to signal to enemies like North Korea and Iran that the United States was unpredictable, all the while not getting involved in an optional and possibly costly overseas misadventure in the Middle East. So there were risks and contradictions, Mr. Hansen says, in Trump's loud maverick foreign policy posture, shared largely only by Senator Rand Paul and his primary rivals. To explain his Jacksonian nationalism, a defiant readiness to retaliate overwhelmingly against aggressors, but not to start optional wars, Trump seemed always to return to the Iraq War 23 to 28. It was his symbol of the entire flawed doctrine of neoconservative elective nation building. In contrast, during the 2016 Republican campaign, most Republican candidates had felt it wise to keep mum about Iraq, not Trump. He sensed an opening and pounced. Okay, I will conclude this shortly. I want to read just a couple of more paragraphs. We have a few minutes left, and you know this is particularly important here. Mr. Hansen goes on to say in this chapter, Trump apparently guessed that his rival Republican senators and governors were somewhat embarrassed that 13 years ago they had supported the removal of Saddam Hussein. But on the other hand, as violence in Iraq had spiked in 2004-06, many erstwhile supporters had long ago squared their circles of support by blaming the Bush administration's incompetent implementation of the occupation and reconstruction. Their new fallback position was analogous to my brilliant 3-week removal of Saddam Hussein, your loused up 4-year aftermath. In part, General David Petraeus, 2006 through 8 surge of troops into Iraq had also quieted the anti-war fervor by mid-2008. When Obama took office in January 2009, more American soldiers were daily dying of accidents worldwide than due to hostile enemy action in Iraq. Iraq and what it portended then was supposedly no longer the contentious issue that had been in the 2004 election. Mr. Hansen goes on to say that in part, a new Republican consensus had also spread that Iraq had finally worked. In 2010, even Vice President Joe Biden had preened, "I am very optimistic about Iraq. I mean, this could be one of the great achievements of this administration." Obama himself had proclaimed the nation to be a sovereign, stable, and self-reliant Iraq with a representative government. That success was his justification for pulling out all U.S. peacekeepers at the beginning of his reelection campaign at the end of 2011. When, Mr. Hansen goes on to say, when Iraq then quickly fell apart in 2012, the Republican boilerplate complaint was that Obama had undermined a secure and stable country, thereby empowering ISIS, written off by Obama, parenthetically, as JVs, to fill the vacuum, to get an idea of something similar to the ensuing chaos. Imagine if President Eisenhower in 1956 had yanked all U.S. troops out of the Korean demilitarized zone to fulfill a campaign promise to end Truman's war, and then assumed Seoul could have survived both its nearby North Korean and regional communist enemies. All right, so we will continue with this rather important chapter in the book, The Case for Trump. We will continue this through the coming weeks. I think it's particularly important as we try to understand what happened. We try to understand what's going on. We try to understand this new phenomena in the form of President Trump as he enters into the political dimension within this country. And in making sense of all of this, we can come to probably a better understanding of how we should think about what we are all about as Americans, how we should think about our role in the world, on the world stage, how we should think about what we should do, what we should plan to do in future national elections, in terms of how we organize ourselves, how we pursue our policy agendas, and how we can embrace this whole idea of make America great again. What exactly does that mean? How can we embrace that? How can we take this and move forward into a brighter future? And to defeat those forces that are out there to try to put us down, try to take us under. All right, so that completes another Throttle Up. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here. And I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye. And we will see you all again next week.